son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know. The death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
And it's another exciting soap opera filled day on Reeks on the Radio. That's right, folks. It is November 13, 2012, 1 minute after the hour, and we have soap opera, a soap opera going on in Washington. Oh, man, this makes Tootsie look good. Okay, if I'm dating myself by referencing an old Dustin Hoffman film, that's my bad. I'm going to have to deal with it. Okay? You know what I mean when I say Tootsie. That was a god-awful film. I don't care how many Academy Awards it won. It was god-awful. But the bottom line is that this is soap opera of that proportion because it's laughable. Tootsie was a comedy. The whole reference. Anyway, let's get into more important stuff. You know the deal. General David Petraeus, former CIA director, Paula Broadwell, the biographer of All In, Jill Kelly, some unpaid liaison, party planner, if you will, and there's so many people, forget about it. I don't watch soap operas. That's why it's so hard for me to keep up with this one. But on the phone with us today is somebody who's obviously qualified to answer the questions we've all been having, because all I've been doing is speculating. It doesn't matter that I'm always right, folks. It doesn't matter that I'm always right, because I'm here to bring someone who can clearly prove that I am right. He is going to solidify everything I've already stated to you since Monday, or since Friday, for that matter. He is going to completely confirm everything that I thought, that I've said, because he is an expert. And his name is Frank Wulko. Now, I want to give you a perfect example. This is an interview that Frank Wulko did some 4 years ago on a local Fox station. On a local Fox station, talking about September 11th. Now, if you don't know who he is, I'll give you all the details, but I just want you to hear this audio. Listen to the words coming right out of his mouth from the video he did some 4 or 5 years ago.
And what about more attacks? Hugo says September 11th is not a target date, but...
Yes, I believe it is inevitable that they will at least attempt to attack again in a major way.
The only question, Hugo says, is when. Warnelli, Fox 13 News.
That's what we have on the show today. Frank Wulko, who predicted it was going to happen and it was going to be in a major way, which is why we have Benghazi today. Now, this man, I want to say young man, Frank Wulko, is a retired U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer, Chief Intelligence Operations at Central Operations Command Central. He is the founder of U.S. Central Command's Intelligence Red Team, and that was during the tenure of David Petraeus. So he knows his stuff, and we're going to ask him a couple of questions and also confirm that I am a genius. I know what I'm talking about here, even though I'm speculating. He is a pro. Welcome to the show, Mr. Frank Wulko. Hello, sir.
Reese, thanks a lot for having me, and I just want to wrap this interview up by saying everything you've said in the past week was 100% right. Can I go finish my dinner now?
Well, I'm sorry. It won't
there
be
you
that.
Go. Your listeners are what a treat. Thanks for having me on, brother. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. So I'm sure you've covered this. I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, for crying out loud, they're talking about it on The View. They're even talking about it on Access Hollywood. Everyone's talking about this because, of course, it's got all the elements of, you know, salacious sex and all that other stuff. But where do you see this? Let me get your take from this. As a former intelligence officer who's covered this stuff and is part of your life, what do you see here?
Well, the one thing I would urge everybody to do, you know, all of your listeners, is to understand that you have two separate things going on here. You've got the tragedy of Benghazi, which is an unforgettable and inexcusable event, and then you've got as a separate issue this extramarital affair that David Petraeus has been involved in, and then this bizarre sort of circle of drama emanating around, you know, right here in Tampa, Florida, through, like you said, this sort of party planner, and now General Allen, the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. The point I want to make there is that if David Petraeus had never been having an affair, Benghazi would have happened and played out exactly the way it did. Even if General Petraeus, you know, him having this affair, that could have happened in a vacuum. Benghazi mm-hmm. would have happened in a vacuum. And neither of the two events really had anything to do with each other until we get into the sort of the post Benghazi attack period.
Right.
And that's when things start to get very, very dicey. For a bunch of reasons, and I'd say most of them are pretty practical, systematic reasons. You've got an embattled administration that is on the coming up on re-election, so you have a kind of a full-scale political panic going on within the White House and within the executive branch, and then you've got David Petraeus with this other scandal kind of hanging over his head, and you have to wonder how much of that played into his willingness to kind of carry the water for the administration, really be the first official in the administration to tell this whopper of a fib about, Benghazi being a spontaneous, uprising.
Yeah.
To
right, being a result of a YouTube trailer.
Yeah, which is probably the only movie in history that might actually be worse than Tootsie and Plan 9 from Outer Space. it's just this obscure video that when I first heard that there was an uprising to this video, I thought maybe it was movie critics in Hollywood and New York. two completely separate issues. So, General Petraeus is, he now has, the weight on his mind and on his shoulders of not only having to square things away at home, which I don't envy him for.
Right.
But he's also got to square himself with the American people. And knowing the way that he typically operates and calculates things, I think in the end he's going to do whatever he thinks is right.
Well, let me ask you a few questions on this, because I know we only got you for a little bit of time here. Let me ask you this. There's speculation today that says that Petraeus goes in, I believe, what is it? It couldn't have been more than, I want to say, 4 or 5 days, maybe even less than that. I think he was one of the first people to speak to the Senate committee on these hearings, and he was the first official to make this response about it being spontaneous and it being about the YouTube video. There are people now who are saying that they were holding this affair over his head for him to sort of carry the water of this, toe the line, if you will, of this line about the YouTube video, using the affair against them, saying, go out there and tell the people that this is, this is what we want you to
yep.
say, or we'll expose it. Do you believe that there's a possibility here? I mean, this is General Petraeus, for crying out loud.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, listen, he showed a lapse in judgment in having the affair. That who knows what kind of pressure he felt he was under. I think the only people who would know that for sure would be the person who would have told him that and David Petraeus himself. Now, regardless of the circumstances, he knew as much as Susan Rice knew when she went before the American people. And right. Everybody else in the administration who said this, Secretary of State, the President himself, they all knew as they continued to hammer this contrived story about this video. They all knew that it wasn't true as they were saying it. And that's why I urge people, I'm like, separate the affair from all this stuff. Because even if he hadn't been having the affair, and mm-hmm. even if that weren't some sort of external pressure or internal pressure he was feeling, you have the entire leadership of the National Security Council, basically, including the president and David Petraeus, saying that, this was just a spontaneous uprising. People got really upset about this video, and they showed up with anti-tank rounds and mortars, and they just spontaneously put together one of the most perfectly executed, coordinated, prolonged terrorist attacks or tactical attacks that we've ever seen. Mm. This would be the equivalent of saying, that those mob flash dances that you see in a mall on right. YouTube just sort of happened. I was at the mall, and like, honest to goodness, all these people just started dancing this perfectly choreographed, Broadway show in the mall because they heard a song. They're ridiculous.
Well, let me ask you this as well, because this has been bothering me the most about this, and I've covered this Benghazi thing on my show since the murders of Ambassador Stevens and the three others, and I always forget their names because there's so many, I try to remember names right off the top of my head, but Tyrone Woods and of course
Glenn Doherty,
sorry,
and Sean Smith,
yes, and.
Yep.
The media literally, I think there was a survey done on how long or how much time was dedicated by the major networks on the Benghazi scandal compared to that of Fox News, who covered it extensively. I think Fox News got 31 minutes in a week, and every other station combined, each network got ABC did a story that was 37 seconds long on
yep.
Benghazi. How the story was changing. They were lackluster. But now this scandal gets involved. It's an affair and this resignation. And now all of a sudden, they can't avoid it. I believe it's a godsend.
Well, what else is – tell that to Mrs. Petraeus and him while he has to come home every night. I'll tell you, this thing, it's today, especially the last 2 days, it's been getting wackier by the hour. I think if you tried to write this up in a script and sell it to Lifetime Movie Network, they'd probably reject it because it sounded too far-fetched and ridiculous. this is unlike anything that I've, ever seen. Now, the media, I would say, and this, we say this so often about media, about mainstream media and all that, that it almost becomes, it's so oversaid and it's overplayed with intention that people now can go, oh, there you go, picking on the mainstream media again. Not this time. I mean, this is one of the worst cases that I think I have ever seen, too, in my lifetime. Another thing, of the media completely ignoring its job as sort of the fourth branch of government to mm-hmm. keep our elected officials honest and keep them, in line with, transparency and information the way that the media was designed to work in the first place. In this case, the media has been acting like an advocacy group for Barack Obama, protecting him from this story. And it's not going to work. I'll tell you what is happening here is that Benghazi is not going to go away. The angles and the number of lies that they have had to tell, that the cover-up that they've had to construe just to get away from the simple truth of what happened that night is now so complicated that, you know, that they're trying to containerize this thing, and the container that they're putting it in is so full of holes that they're running out of things to plug the holes with. And it's taken on water fast. So they are not going to escape Benghazi. They know it. You've got Democrats, very powerful ones in the Senate, like Dianne Feinstein,
mm-hmm.
who are quite frankly livid. You know, that, I mean, Dianne Feinstein did not sign up, did not dedicate her life to becoming the chairman of one of the most powerful committees in the Senate, to be told to go take a time out in the corner and keep her mouth shut. And she is plenty ticked off, from what I understand, over the fact that she was kept in the dark regarding the FBI investigation into Petraeus.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us, we're on the phone with Frank Wilco, who's a retired U.S. Naval Intelligence officer and also founder of the U.S. Central Command's Intelligence Red Team, and also the host of the Frank Wilco radio show. You know, you're absolutely right about this whole thing about, you know, the dereliction of duty by the media in all this. But, and you know, it's funny that you said that whole thing about, you know, how I said it was a godsend, and you say, well, you're sure it's not from Mrs. Petraeus. But you know what? I always go back to what Spock said in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. It's unfortunate that they have to go through this. But, you know, this is our people who are serving the American people. And their private lives and their indiscretions, while they're on, you know, pretty much on our dime, you know, they have to be scrutinized. You know, I do feel bad. My wife says it all the time. She feels awful about what his wife has to go through. But I still look at it as, you know, this is a public figure who works for the, you know, people of the United States. And you know what? I don't care whether or not this is wrecking their marriage. I want to get back. I want to get to the truth of this all. And I'm glad that the media, although they can only grab at what they want to, and in this case, they love this kind of stuff. But now they can't avoid Benghazi.
No, they can't, because now the you know, they have to make the connection now between the post September 11th, 2012 storyline. And the administration's timeline is a disaster. I mean, they are, the battling timelines between the Department of Defense, the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, is a comedy almost. It's a tragic comedy. And this you know, piece of it has brought it all to the fore. Now, let me say something sort of in, not really in Petraeus' defense, but you know, certainly somebody in a position like that, I think this is what really sort of turned the people off of this country, you know, and has made him the brunt of jokes, you know, even though he's still somewhat, he's pretty revered. But, you know, Bill Clinton, I mean, he's the butt of, you know, late night jokes. You can't put Bill Clinton's name alongside another woman or a photo of him with another woman or whatnot. Where,
right.
You know, I'm sorry, people expect better from these folks. You know, they really do. And I'll tell you, the one thing that happens with folks who are, and apparently even our most senior guys, having been deployed a number of times to, you know, the forward areas, whether it's, you know, Iraq, Qatar, you know, Afghanistan, Africa, those places, I'll tell you, when people get into those areas and you're deployed and you're really a universal way, you are completely in a new reality. You are so far from home. You are so far and so completely detached with anything that, you know, that relates to you and who you are when you're at home and around your families and that, and so focused on what's going on while you're overseas that you really do. You enter a different dimension of reality. And like many other walks of life, people are susceptible. People become vulnerable. I'll tell you, David Petraeus, not making excuses for him, but you have to understand that this is a man who has been deployed for almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Unimaginable. I mean, David Petraeus spent probably 7 of the last 10 years of his life deployed, away from home, away from his family.
Sure.
High biz guy, but you know what? I don't care who you are. You know, he is. he's a human being. He was put in a dumb situation. He made bad choices and vulnerable guy. And you know, that's here we are. You know, we're learning that people like David Petraeus are human beings.
Let me ask you this, Frank, if I may. Much has been made of Paula Broadwell, and it's when I say much has been made, I'm not talking about whether or not she had an affair, whether or not she was crazy about
him. I just made a balloon animal of her today, actually.
Say again?
I just made a balloon animal of her today.
Well, you're going to have to post that. I have to see that.
I'm putting the final touches on it with a Sharpie right now.
But, you know, much has been made in my circles and in places where I've been about the comments that she made in Denver, at the University of Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And at the University of Denver, she made those claims about these detainees that were in Benghazi.
Yep.
You know, that Fox News reported this today. Let me play this audio of what they reported on Fox News today, roughly at about 6:30 today.
The CIA is denying that any prisoners were being held at that CIA annex in Benghazi, saying in a very carefully worded statement that the CIA got out of the detention business in 2009.
Well, our principal source, Brett, who was at the annex on September 11th, says there were three Libyan detainees who were handed over to the Libyan security forces that night. Our colleague Adam Housley has sources on the ground in Benghazi saying the CIA annex was being used as a processing facility for detainees, despite the 2009 executive order signed by President Obama barring these black sites. Daily Beast reporter Eli Lake reported on January 28, 2009, when he worked for the Washington Times, that there was a loophole in the executive order that enabled the CIA to hold prisoners for a few days for questioning, quote, a little notice exception that allows the spy agency to continue to operate temporary detention facilities abroad.
Now, my question to that is, could that be a part of this cover-up? Here's President Obama right at the front of his administration in 2009, saying that we are no longer following the CIA rendition sort of practices of the Bush administration, and here it is that they were quietly doing them anyway. And is the administration, or in your opinion, are they fearful that that will then make this administration look even worse? Could that be part of the cover-up?
Absolutely. I've told many people this over the last several weeks that, you know, as bad as people think Benghazi is right now, what people know now, I can assure you that it's much worse than anybody
mm-hmm.
even understands today. And this latest piece of information coming from the Wall Street Journal reporter is just part of that. And another thing that people are going to have to – that people in Congress will probably – be asking and inquiring about is what was Ambassador Stevens doing frequenting Benghazi so often? What or who was at that consulate facility? It was a consulate facility that was basically under rebuild and reconstruction to become a full-fledged consulate. But either way, you know, he was frequenting the consulate, you know, probably more so than you know, he would normally have to in the course of his duties.
Right.
People are going to want to know why that is. You know, the deal that brought him to Benghazi that night, you know, one of the activities that the CIA was up to out of that facility there was to recapture or re-custody weapons that we had given
mm-hmm.
Libyan rebels.
Right.
Ostensibly Libyan rebels, in this case, who turned out to be al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists, Ansar al-Sharia. Now, if they insisted not on dealing with lower-level CIA agents for the turnover of weapons, if they had been watching Ambassador Stevens' frequent trips and travels with very limited security into and out of Benghazi, and had been able to sort of target him and get and suss his security detail out, and they insisted that he be the person that they deal with on the evening of September 11th, 2012 for this weapons deal, he may very well have been invited to his own assassination by Ansar al-Sharia.
It's funny that you bring that up, because, you know, there are some conspiracy theories out there, and I'd like to get your take on this. I've never mentioned this on the air. I read it. I thought about it. I said, I discussed it with my wife even and went, you know, nothing's impossible in this administration. Had you heard anything about this rumor that there was a possible idea to do a swap for Ambassador Stevens for the blind sheikh?
I've heard that, and you know, I've only heard that in, you know, the places where I typically, you know, it's not enough for me to make anything of it. There is enough. I'll tell you, there is enough bizarre activity surrounding this, without even developing new theories as to why he may have been going there.
Right.
You know, it's so that, yeah, the rumors abound, but that I don't. I'm not sure. I certainly don't think that was the case. I mean, it's enough if the ambassador himself was involved in, you know, weapons re-custody deals with known terrorists to sort of, again, re-custody weapons that we had given them to fight Muammar Gaddafi, so that we could send those weapons into Syria now, where Syrian rebels could use them without the funding and permission of Congress to fight against anti-Bashar al-Assad forces.
Right.
And that whole thing came undone on September 11th, 2012. You can, understanding how politically hungry, you know, some of these politicians can be, they went into a full-fledged political panic.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's interesting that you say this, because, you know, I always harken back to the Iran-Contra scandal. And, you know, I talk about that a little bit, and how the parallels between that and Libya are somewhat similar. You know, by not having U.S. forces on the ground or to assist the Libyan people in fighting against Muammar Gaddafi, by using NATO forces, it was a lot easier to get our weapons into the hands of what now turns out to be Al-Qaeda light or low-carb Al-Qaeda. I mean, wasn't that in essence what happened?
Very much. I mean, let me tell you about Benghazi itself. As a region of Libya, when we were fighting, when things were going bad for us in Iraq, you know, in the 2003-2004 time frame before the surge, you know, one of the big problems we had was what we called foreign fighters. One of the richest sources of foreign mujahideen flowing into Iraq was Libya.
Mm-hmm.
90% of the Libyan jihad force that came into Iraq came from Benghazi. Benghazi is a petri dish of jihadist activity. It blooms, you know, jihad movements. So the fact that we were with very little vetting, and as effectively as we possibly could, leading from behind on dealing with some of these unknown groups in Libya, nobody should be shocked or surprised to learn that the people we were handing these heavy weapons to, including surface-to-air missiles, were actually Al-Qaeda surrogates.
But was removing Gaddafi, do you believe that as an intelligence officer who's followed this, and Gaddafi's been around since what? I was one? What did he do?
Since
1969?
I believe the coup was in 1973 or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. It could have been a couple years earlier.
I'm almost certain. I know he's 69. I know Morsi is a little later. Not Morsi. What am I saying? Mubarak is a little later. But I know I know Gaddafi took over the year I was born, 1969. But here's my question. With all of that, after September 11th, Gaddafi declares he's no longer going to pursue weapons of mass destruction.
Yep.
He's given up his quote unquote world domination, you know, sort of ideals. You know, why would this administration think that it was important to remove him in what I would consider Libya wasn't a hotbed of? I mean, what happened was an uprising. It wasn't Gaddafi going out and just killing people at random. This was an uprising. This was an Arab Spring.
Right.
This
And you understand too that for several years before, the Arab Spring, that is the United States government, sort of out of good faith for the fact that Muammar Gaddafi gave us full access to his, weapons of mass destruction program. Mm-hmm. Here we are. This is what drives people nuts about the United States of America and why they feel it's a wonder anybody trusts us, is Muammar Gaddafi and his sons bend over backwards and forwards for 5 years, coming back into the good graces of the United States and the West, and they're pretty much doing everything we're telling them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, new administration comes in, this Arab Spring uprising occurs, and it's like none of the progress we had made with Muammar Gaddafi over the previous 4 to 5 years ever happened. So I can tell you that the and same thing with Mubarak. Overnight we sort of transform Mubarak from being a strong kind of dictatorial leader or president for life kind of guy into
right.
the worst person since Adolf Hitler.
Yeah,
and
I found that amazing. He was the guy who in a lot of ways was that buffer between the rest of the Arab world and Israel, and now that's gone.
Well, absolutely, and I think you hit on a very important point there. This White House, too, is heavily advised, and also not heavily staffed, but it is staffed by people who are very close to, if not active members of either the Muslim Brotherhood or Muslim Brotherhood surrogate organizations here in the United States. So these are people between the president and the secretary of state who have done nothing but drink through a fire hose the party line from the Muslim Brotherhood for the past 20 years of their lives. And they believe it. They believe every word of it. So it's this is what we get. Now, I'll say, too, a lot of this is, here we are having this conversation, week and a half or so after the election. Mm-hmm. And one of the kind of, I guess, sad things to me is, folks like you and I can sit around and talk about this stuff amongst ourselves and with your listeners. I'm not sure if you have listeners from all walks of life or if this is conservative radio show or what, but apparently it's we've got to do more to tell people who are sort of uninitiated or don't understand, because as it sits right now, there's at least half of this country, as far as I can see, it doesn't seem to care. I don't care if we had videotape of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton themselves walking out of the Benghazi consulate, having beaten, our guys to death themselves with sackfuls of puppies. It doesn't really seem to matter.
Well, Frank, let me tell you this. As a strong conservative, African-American for that, so I get a lot of heat. The one thing
boy.
I say to Obama...
I was just about to accuse you of being a racist.
Well, of course. It doesn't matter. I don't care if they call me a racist. I like that term. one thing I always say is Obama supporters... The perfect analogy of Obama supporters are this. If Obama slapped a baby in the face, the first question they would ask is, well, what did the baby do? That's
yeah.
who they
no,
are.
I am. There is, the looking at this just as a man, as a guy, forget what my walk of life has been, right after Benghazi occurred, if you look at the massive intelligence leaks that very senior members of the administration have conducted, very senior sure. members of the National Security Council just handing over some of our most sensitive ongoing operations to the New York Times and Benghazi, and Barack Obama's first response to both of those has been, I'm offended. I find that offensive. That you would say something like that about me is highly offensive. And people respond to that like he's the king. Oh my goodness, we've offended the crown. I've never seen anything like this in any president that I've ever seen in this country.
What I find more appalling, Frank, what I find more appalling is that the New York Times gets its information from the White House, gets all of that intel, prints it in the newspaper, and doesn't even scrutinize the fact that it's unheard of that an administration would do it.
Yeah. No, not at all. I mean, you're right. I will tell you that those security leaks, pre-Benghazi, I'm talking when they were leaking all of the information on the bin Laden raid, information they leaked landed the Pakistani physician in prison for the rest of his natural life, however long that lasts him.
Sure.
Ongoing operations, specially compartmented information that people all over government have to sign non-disclosure agreements when they're read into these programs. Either Tom Donilon or somebody high in the National Security Agency walked right into a luxury hotel room in New York City, Washington, D.C., and just handed this stuff to the New York Times. And nobody at the New York Times had the presence of mind to go, maybe we shouldn't. You know, I mean, those were active, ongoing operations, agents and operators on the ground at the time, and things that are of the most sensitive nature that I've been working on and have worked with during the past 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. Your last word, and I've kept you much longer than Stephanie allowed me to, and I'm so glad you stayed on. Your final thoughts on these hearings that are going to be taking place. I mean, some half a dozen hearings that are going to take place. Do you expect this thing? Do you expect some bombshells, or is there anything in particular you believe is going to happen or is going to come out of this that I don't want to use the word rooting for, but you're hoping comes out of this or think will come out of this?
Well, yeah. I mean, what I'm hoping comes out of this is the truth. And that is one thing, inexcusably. I don't care if, you know, Mahatma Gandhi came back from the dead and he was president of the United States. You know, we expect the truth from the servants that we send to these high positions. You know, the President of the United States he presides over our constitutional republic, period. That's his job. What I would hope to get out of these hearings is just the truth. And you know what? It's going to suck for the administration to tell the truth because it's ugly. But the American people deserve it, and there's no excuse, no matter who's in charge or what the agenda or what the hopes and dreams of people were for a person to conceal the truth when we have four families who are pretty much being ignored by the government that sent them to be killed. So what I hope comes out is the truth. I hope people like Dianne Feinstein and other ranking Democrats on, you know, both committees have decided that, there are certain things that are not worth our political agenda. And this thing is so ugly that
even if they're looking at this from a political or politicized way, they have to remember that only ignoring it will come back to bite them on the rear.
Absolutely. And they can't. Benghazi, it's too big. They're not going to be able to put this thing to sleep.
If Valerie Plame was this big, if Watergate was this big, if Attorney General Gonzalez and the seven attorneys that were unceremoniously fired,
yep.
If that was all huge, okay, no one died in any of those. We've got four Americans dead. If all of those were huge front page stories and this isn't, there's no way. It just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it doesn't. And it shows you that the cover-up is much wider than anybody could possibly have ever imagined. And it does include, you know, actively the media. And I just think that hopefully this is a new chapter in the way we do business here. This makes Watergate look like child's play.
You know what? It makes Watergate look like what Richard Nixon said it was, a third-rate break-in.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And what was lost? Campaign secrets from a party. It wasn't even classified information.
Exactly. That's exactly what it looks like. Well, thank you again, folks, on the phone with us. And please check them out. Mr. Frank Wuko of the Frank Wuko Radio Show. Your station is WFLA in Florida. You can listen online no matter where, right?
Absolutely, through iHeartRadio, WFLA 970, right here in Tampa, the heart of scandal and intrigue now. Once again, Florida is the center of the weirdness vortex on planet Earth.
Hey, look, when a party planner has access to the FBI on this scale, you've got to ask yourself some questions.
Yeah. Well, you know what? If she doesn't post those shirtless pictures of that guy, then none of this was worth it.
Well, exactly. We've got to appeal to those people who pick up.
The ladies want to know.
Yeah, exactly. We got to appeal to the Us Weekly and National Enquirer readers too.
Absolutely. All right, my brother. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Having you on. That's Frank Wuko. Folks, make sure you check him out weeknights from 2 to 4 p.m. weeknights on WFLA. You can go to iHeartRadio to check him out. We'll be back. Here's Everlast. This is a song I actually fell in love with for a little while. We'll check it out. We'll be back shortly with more. Your questions, numbers 347-308-8701. It's Reset on the Radio. We'll be right back.
Get you.
the hour right here on blogtalkradio.com, November the 13th, 2012. We just had Frank Wulko on the line. He is the founder of the U.S. Central Command's Intelligence Red Team, and that was during the tenure of David Petraeus. So he's worked with General Petraeus and worked under his tenure. He's also a retired U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer and Chief Intelligence Operations at Special Operations Command Central. Also, he'd like you to check out FrankWuko.com, and that's W-U-C-O. That's FrankWuko.com. JC is getting some audio that we're going to try to play on the air. There's an amazing thing that Frank Wulko does that almost literally had him scoped by the FBI when he was on his own radio show talking about jihad and jihadist. And we'll get into that later because I want to surprise you and really, really listen to what this guy knows his stuff, and he is literally in the hearts and minds of terrorists and what it is that, you know, what they think, how they feel. He's an asset and a friend to have, and we're happy to have him on the show. I got to get Malcolm Out Loud back on the show too. I'm going to see if I can get these two together to debate or even just have a conversation. Nonetheless, let's bring on Dennis the Mass Menace. Dennis.
Hi, Reese.
What's going on, buddy?
I had a lot of questions for him. Maybe I can ask them, and if he's listening, or pass them on. The first question would have been, what's America going to be in post-Obama? And it will be, sooner or later, a post-Obama era.
Sure.
What do we do to repair our foreign relations, for instance, around the world, when the American word cannot be held as a guarantee of protection? The second
thing I would
ask...
You believe that Obama will do to this country as far as its reputation is concerned. You believe
what's going to happen, the trajectory, and it's not just Obama. Many administrations have gone back on their word. We see it with Carter in Iran, and we see it in Nicaragua when the Sandinistas came in. Many countries have depended on the word of the United States to defend them, and then there'd be a change or the heat becomes too much politically for this administration, any administration, to bear, and then they jettison them. And the American people don't seem to care after a couple of rumblings. So
well,
I was going to ask about what's going to happen in the post-Obama world.
Remember, when I look at it this way, Dennis, remember what it is that they said about what America was like during the Bush administration and whether or not Obama was going to be able to repair that. Truth be told, I don't believe that any world leader looks at the current administration and then says, because of that previous administration, that is the way that America looks at it. They understand that our elections are a change of ideas or a change of ideals. You know, if it stays one particular path, you know, let's say a perfect example. When Ronald Reagan served his two terms and then went to Herbert Walker Bush, I'm sure foreign leaders said, okay, Herbert Walker Bush will probably be just like Ronald Reagan. But when Clinton came into office, I'm pretty sure world leaders said, oh, change of regime. Okay, let's see how they do things differently. They're almost enthusiastic about how the country or its direction is going to change once the leadership changes in that fashion.
But that's not quite what I'm saying. It's one thing to have a change of administration, and it's quite another to have treaty obligations or close to treaty obligations, and then you abandon your allies like we're doing to Israel. But that's another question.
Right.
Now, the other question I was going to ask him, what he thought of SIGINT versus HUMINT, and are we relying too much on SIGINT?
I'm sorry, against?
HUMINT.
Humans versus what?
No, signal intelligence versus human intelligence. Boots on the ground to espionage.
Right.
In other words, with the post-Church hearings back in the 70s, they threw away all the assets, the human assets, and they said, well, we're going to rely more on maybe signals intelligence, satellite and that. And I feel that that's no substitute for a human on the ground, an espionage agent, to be able to determine what a real story is and separate fact from fiction and analyze where a machine cannot do or a drone cannot do.
Well, right, exactly. Do you really believe that we don't use human intelligence in a fashion that we used before, or do you believe it's considerably scaled down?
Considerably scaled.
I agree with you on the considerably scaled down. But I don't believe that we still don't use it. In fact, I don't believe that any administration would believe that human intelligence is obsolete. I don't believe
that.
Oh,
it's not obsolete. You brought up the problem in Pakistan about the man in the prison who ratted out on bin Laden.
Right.
Why didn't we exfiltrate him?
We
infiltrate, but we also exfiltrate.
Right. Exactly. We protect someone like him who helps us, and we make sure that he doesn't fall into the hands of people like Pakistanis who, regardless of what anybody says, isn't an ally, clearly isn't an ally.
So
and,
if you can't exfiltrate an asset on the ground, what do we say to others who might be thinking of helping the United States when down the line they're going to be betrayed? You're just not going to get that information. It's not going to come forth. And the other thing I was going to ask, and I can ask you, Reese, too, you're talking about the leak in the New York Times. If we're talking about secrets, why is it every secret seems to be dissolved like a sieve in D.C., except what is the great big question that hasn't ever been leaked? Obama's records.
That's,
you
make
think
a
of
very,
it.
Very
all
valid
his records,
point, my friend.
All his records, they're clammed up, they're tight, but national defense secrets, it's like a sieve in Washington. A sieve. It's always been that way. That's why certain presidents don't like to go down up the hill and testify before Congress, like Dick Nixon. You know, damn right well, and he said it was like himself. He said, "When you go to the hill, it's like a sieve. I must be talking to Brezhnev." It's a system wide. It's not just Obama, but there's something going on in this country that's rotten, and we can't even find out not only what the secrets are, but the people could give a damn less because American Idol is on. Dancing with the Stars is on. Don't bother me. What the hell kind of country
have we
inherited?
Are the new me generation, and technology has secured that. Technology and Twitter and Facebook, that is all secured. I laugh because, I look at guys like you, Dennis. I look at guys like you. I look at guys like White Mike. Even sometimes I see – well, JC doesn't do it as often as you and I do. But when I look at guys like you and I, and I'm not trying to blow sunshine or anything like that. But I look at your Facebook postings, and I look at my Facebook postings. I look at all my old Facebook postings, like I've done in the past year. I look at the stuff that I posted. Do you notice that everything I post is always news? As you do the same thing. It's always about trying to inform, make sure that people know that stuff is out there, make sure that they, they don't miss those stories. It's very rare when I post something personal. And that's because I don't believe that social media is to tell somebody that I just had a hard-boiled egg.
I just try to inform and maybe push the envelope a little bit with information so it might make a slight difference. I had no idea you were reading the stuff I push out.
No, I read it all the time. If it pops up on my screen, I check it out. When you changed your Facebook profile photo to the CIA, I thought it was hilarious. I was like, how perfect is that?
Well, then you saw the what I posted, and I thought it was so good I copyrighted my statement today. I said, the only thing made in America these days is an invoice.
Is an invoice?
Yep.
You might be slightly right. Always slightly. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's how bad it's gotten. It's gotten pretty
bad.
Now,
how did you two meet? I'll do my little quick interview. How did you two guys meet? Was
Frank Wuko?
Professionally in the radio? Yeah. Was it
days? Frank Wuko, there's a publicity company that I'm involved with, and they give me an update every day on potential guests. But I already knew about him, and when I found out he was one of their clients, I immediately jumped on him. You know, just like when I got Lindsay Lohan's dad, Michael, on the show. There's a guy, Jason, who works with a publicity company that I'm linked up with. They told me that they had him and they wanted to bring him on the show. So, you know, whenever they contact me and they have somebody that they want on the show, I'll grab them.
Geez, I wonder if Fallon Finneran is available now.
I would love to have Finneran on the air.
He's off the air, you know.
I heard.
Call him up and ask him.
You know what? Let's work
on
that.
All I can say is no.
Nah, Finneran will talk to me. Are you crazy? Finneran will talk to me. He's never had anything against me.
That'd be a hell of a show, the in and outs of Boston politics.
Whew, of course. Absolutely. And he can talk freely about Howie Carr.
Yeah, Howie, Whitey, and Kevin White.
Absolutely. All right, let's take a break. We'll be back at the top of the hour shortly right here on Resunder Radio. Thanks, Dennis. Stick around. That's not working. I've got a button problem. Oh, come on. I'm sorry.
Switch.
These are the things. This is what happens on Resunder Radio. There we go. Thank you.
Warning, the sound you're about to hear can be devastating to your ear.
I love it, I love it.
You're listening to Reese on the Radio right here on blogtalkradio.com.
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know. The death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled.
That's a little premature. Reese on the Radio, 2 minutes after the hour. We are back right here on blogtalkradio.com. It is November the 13th, 2012. I've got to play this audio, folks, because, you know, as many people may believe, the African-American community, they're not very happy about the re-election of Barack Obama. Yes, they may have been pushed out there by, you know, the surrogates of the Obama campaign, pushed out there in a full-throated effort to get these people out there. And they were manipulated. Of course they were. You know, re-elect Barack Obama. You know, the boogeyman, he's coming. Mitt Romney is the boogeyman. There was no celebration, folks. We have to understand that Barack Obama did not get the same numbers that he got 4 years ago. They were lower. African Americans did vote for Barack Obama overwhelmingly. There's no denying that. But these African Americans are not, they're not satisfied. They're not satisfied with this administration. Sure, they're going to support Barack Obama, but even black people know when they have to keep making excuses for their candidate, they know deep down, they'll never reveal that to you. They'll never reveal that to the common folk, as far as they're concerned. They'll never reveal that they're unsatisfied. They will only say that it's someone else's fault. It's always someone else's fault. They will never, ever reveal failure. And there are some people out there who know that this president is and always will be a failure. And they fear the reckoning. They fear it. One of those individuals is a professor by the name of Cornel West. And Cornel West is upset. He's disillusioned. No, wrong word. He's dissatisfied. He's dissatisfied. He's dissatisfied with people who have a pulpit, if you will, who are not holding the president responsible. He knows that the president isn't doing its job. We need to scrutinize him to make sure, to ensure that he does better. If we patronize the first black president as black people, and we give him a pass, we allow him to ignore the problems and situations that are going on that are plaguing the black community. This man is the president of the United States. They have hope for him. And with that hope comes responsibility. We have hope for you, brother. Do you understand that we are sitting up here all of these years of oppression, and we have a black president?
president, and we have hope for you, brother. And then you ignore us. Then you beg us for our vote. You make matters worse, and then you ask us for our vote. Just based on the premise of, hey, have my back. You know what I'm saying? African Americans for Barack Obama, you know what's up, son. And they do it. And Cornel West, who's an educated man, see, this proves to me that although Cornel West is not a wizard of smart, but he is a smart man. And after a while, you really, really start to pay attention. As a smart person, you have to pay attention. The writing's on the wall, and sometimes you can't avoid it. And what I give to Cornel West, and I think a lot of people on the right of this argument do, it's the reason why we don't ostracize Cornel West. And the reason why Cornel West is the first man. Notice, Cornel West, he's not on MSNBC. Cornel West, he's not on CNN. Cornel West is a leftist. He is a strong leftist, but he shows up on Fox whenever he's asked. He goes in there and he debates each and every one of those hosts, even if he doesn't agree with them. He shows up there with Sean Hannity. He shows up there on with Bill O'Reilly. He shows up. And this is what everybody else is considered the far right, the O'Reillys and the Hannitys. But who shows up? Who's a leftist, and a leftist in every way? Cornel West. And he gets on those shows and he debates them. I don't agree with him, but he has honest debate. And at the end of the program, he still calls Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity my brother. He still treats them like equals. Even though everything he talks about is partisan. He talks about blackness. He talks about minority. He talks about the poor. But in no way does he treat any one of those men like the devil. So that's the reason why I've always given Cornel West the most respect. I've ripped him at times when he's gotten ridiculous. But he is an honest and fair man. I'll never forget the first time I ever met him. Fell in love with the guy just for him being there. Fell in love with him. He just had that aura about him. And he's a genuine man. Can be a bit of a knucklehead sometimes on his thinking. But he's an honest man. And when Cornel West says this, when he says this to Al Sharpton and Michael Eric Dyson and Melissa Harris Perry over at MSNBC, you've got to listen. You've got to listen. Because it doesn't matter who you are. As far as Cornel West is concerned, he has one calling, and his calling is for those in this country who are poor, those who are without, those who need. I don't agree with his tactics that government should dole out that money to make sure that they survive, but that's his calling. That's what he believes. And when you do not, even though these people, you look at Al Sharpton, you look at Michael Eric Dyson, you look at Melissa Harris Perry, whom he's talking about in this piece, they claim to be the people who are fighting for those poor people. And here, Cornel West is calling them out.
I love Brother Mike Dyson, too. But we're living in a society where everybody's up for sale. Everything's up for sale. And he and Brother Sharpton and Sister Melissa and others, they have sold their souls for a mess of Obama pottage. And we invite them back to the black prophetic tradition after Obama leaves. But at the moment, they want insider access, and they want to tell those kind of lies. They want to turn their back to poor and working people.
Well,
and it's a sad thing to see them as apologists for the Obama administration in that way, given the kind of critical background that all of them have had at some point.
Now, he's on a show called Democracy Now! And Democracy Now! Is a far left-leaning television show. They don't want Cornel West on that show ripping Michael Eric Dyson, Melissa Harris Perry, and Al Sharpton. They don't want him doing that. That's why that white woman on the show is cutting him off. She doesn't even want him to finish his statement because he's being critical
of the people they want to shill for President Obama. She's cutting them off because she wants to say, shut up, nigga. They're doing good work. You don't get to criticize them. How dare you call yourself a liberal? Shut up, nigga. I don't care how smart you are. They're on TV. They got more viewers than I got. They got a third of everybody else. They got a third of the Price is Right audience, but they got an audience. You cannot be talking like that. Shut up, nigga. Understand your place.
I love Brother Mike Dyson, too. But we're living in a society where everybody's up for sale. Everything's up for sale. And he and Brother Sharpton and Sister Melissa and others, they have sold their souls for a mess of Obama pottage. And we invite them back to the black prophetic tradition after Obama leaves. But at the moment, they want insider access, and they want to tell those kind of lies. They want to turn their back to poor and working people.
Well,
and it's a sad thing to see them as apologists for the Obama administration in that way, given the kind of critical background that all of them have had at some point.
Calling them an Obama apologist. This man is telling his black cohorts, compadres, contemporaries, whatever. He's telling them that you've sold your soul to the devil. They're selling themselves for insider access. But at what cost? Now, do I have this Melissa Harris Perry piece? I hope I still have it. I may have deleted it. But this is, you know, this is clearly, you know, what he's talking about. Oh, please don't tell me I deleted it. I really, really need this. Come on. Please don't tell me that I deleted it. Because it is, this is the best audio ever. Of Harris Perry losing her mind. Oh, I don't have it anymore. Oh, that just sucks. Oh, I can't believe I don't have it anymore. But this woman lost her mind talking about the streets that she lived on. You guys remember that? When she was screaming and hollering about how she walks down the street in her neighborhood and poor people lived down the block from her. She claims to be fighting for those people, for the little ones. And here's Cornel West calling it like it is. You can't sit up here and say that you care about the poor. You can't sit up here and say that you care about those who have lost their way and need help, and yet shill for the Obama administration and promote those lies, as he put it, not me, as he put it, promote those lies. It's a horrible day. It's a horrible day when Cornel West has to call out any one of these people in the way that he has, calling out Sharpton. I mean, what's Sharpton going to say about Cornel West? Is he going to call him an Uncle Tom? Is he going to call Cornel West a sellout? Is he going to say Cornel West is he going to call him a Republican? Is he going to call him a fake Democrat? Is he even going to challenge him? Steve Harvey already has, but Steve Harvey's no consequence here. So not even. It doesn't even make any sense. Forgive me for even mentioning him. He's a 2-bit radio host. And I say that while I'm online. I've got gall. But it's an important thing to consider. It's a very important thing to consider. They've sold their souls, and Cornel West is calling them out. And I'm actually glad he did it, regardless of his politics. I'm glad he did it. I'm glad he stepped up and said something. Sounds familiar.
The president is in the White House because of the civil rights movement, and I was a leader in that movement. And I didn't march 1 inch, 1 foot, 1 yard for a man to marry a man and a woman to marry a woman. So the president has forgotten the price that was paid, where people died, where they suffered, where they gave their blood to have equal rights in the United States. And for the homosexual community and for the president to bow to the money, as Judas did with Jesus Christ, is a disgrace, and we are ashamed. We will not take it back. We will not back down. So we are going to take action across this country to change the course that this president is carrying us here.
Thank you.
21 minutes after the hour right here on Reese on the Radio on blogtalkradio.com. The Rolling Stones, Give Me Shelter, November the 13th, 2012. You know, much has been made about this this story that's been everywhere. Everyone's talking about it. I don't know what the big deal is, but I got to be honest with you, folks. It means nothing. So apparently some 40 states have signed a petition to secede from the United States. Texas being the most prominent one because there is a small piece of law within the Constitution when Texas joined the Union that says that under some circumstances they can secede. Now, I read this story today because Texas is the most important. Now, there are layers of this that must be understood. The most important being that the reason why Texas is getting this sort of attention is because of the Civil War, is because of Texas when it comes to the Civil War, that it's got some, how do you put it? It's got some connection here, for lack of a better word. Now, I've looked at this story, and it was in the Daily Caller. Petitions seeking White House approval to secede now come from 47 states. Now, I believe that a petition is supposed to be done where if you can get 25,000 people or more within 30 days that want to approve this measure, you then send that to the White House. And if you could do that within 30 days, the White House will look over it and then respond. Well, I believe before 30 days even came up, some 50,000 people had signed this online petition to secede from the United States to create its own government. Some other states have done just as much. They've been able to get the 25,000 signatures. There's going to be plenty of speculation. Let me give you mine before you hear everybody else's, if you haven't heard anybody else's. Most people are going to believe that this has more to do with bitterness or anger over the election. Of course, that's where most of it is stemming from. I'm sure a lot of it is stemming from that. Because, of course, those who lost, sort of sore losers. And, you know, they're angry. It's obvious that they're angry. They're affected by this. And this has touched them in a very personal way. They've lost elections before, ladies and gentlemen. Conservatives have lost elections before. I'm pretty sure that you do not see people out there freaking. You haven't seen people freaking out there. But this, for some odd reason, was way more relevant. Let me just read from the story, and then I'll bring JC and Dennis in on this. Conservatives have voted more than 375,000 times since Election Day to pick up their marbles and go home. That's how many virtual signatures appeared Monday night as clocks in Washington, D.C. chime midnight on petitions asking President Barack Obama's administration to allow 47 of the 50 U.S. states to secede from the country. A petition from an Arlington, Texas man launched November 9th via the Obama White House website's We the People tool had more than 58,000 signatures. That's more than twice the 25,000 it had on Monday morning, a number required to trigger an automatic White House review, according to the administration's own published rules. Now, again, this is their published rules, so they have to follow this particular template. A similar petition from a Louisiana native crossed the 25,000 threshold as Monday drew to a close on the East Coast. Launched November 7th, the day after Obama won re-election, the Pelican State Spark set off an internet-driven cascade of disaffected Tea Partiers and other conservatives looking, as one petition organizer told the Daily Caller, just to do something, anything, to show we're not going away quietly. It's not clear whether or to what extent individuals are signing more than one petition. The White House's online rules do not prohibit Americans from signing a petition that would not affect the states where they live. In essence, you can sign anywhere you want, even if you don't live in that state. The complete list of states with open petitions includes Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Arizona, California, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Virginia, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. Nine states, We Are the People entries include multiple competing petitions, the Daily Caller determined, to be California, Georgia, Missouri, New York, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Wisconsin, are each represented by at least two positions. The Daily Caller was able to locate three for Pennsylvania. Wow. The only three states that lack secession petitions were Maine, Vermont, and Washington. According to the White House, petitions have 30 days to gather 25,000 signatures before the administration will automatically review them. At least one occasion, however, President Obama responded to a petition that collected 12,240 signatures, a request for the White House beer recipe. Yes. 12,000 people actually petitioned for the beer recipe. Really? They really did that. 12,240. Yeah, that's enough to make me want to slap a lot of people. Anyway, the story goes on. The White House website petitions are largely a symbolic measure. Serious observers don't expect the federal government to allow any state to withdraw from the U.S. on the basis of electronic yes votes from Louisiana's case, less than 0.5% of its residents. Any realistic effort to turn 50 states into 49 would have to originate from the state's government, not from the White House or its website. And the U.S. Constitution is silent on the legality of any state declaring itself independent. Now, this is what I mentioned earlier. The Civil War, of course, saw several such efforts, the last one by North Carolina in 1861. But Middlebury College in Vermont, ironically, one of the few states not involved in the current website politicking, held nationwide secessionist meetings in 2006 and 2007, drawing delegations from at least 10 states. One Vermont group, the Second Vermont Republic, says its goal is to extricate Vermont peacefully from the United States as soon as possible, I'm sure, because of Bush. In the 2006 case, the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that it's illegal for the state to secede from the U.S., blocking a ballot initiative organizers from putting their measure to a vote in that year's election. Texas, however, raised more threats of secession than Americans anywhere else, because of an urban myth holds that the Republic of Texas retained the option of withdrawing from the U.S. when it joined the Union in 1845. While Texas has no special power to leave the United States, it may have an option no other state can boast. In the resolution that Texas passed authorizing the U.S. to annex its territory, it specifically spelled out how Texas could be divided into as many as five separate territories. Each one, the agreement read, would be entitled to admission to it as a new U.S. state. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, his office did not immediately respond to an inquiry asking what would happen if Texas subdivided into five states. They're suddenly entitled to 10 U.S. senators instead of two, because Texas has two, and now if they were to break up into five, then it would be 10. What would happen if that should take place in Texas? That means that the Senate would then be Republican. So that's the story. So are they leaving? No one knows. Will they leave? I don't know. But it's quite... Hey, if I were Texas,
I'd do it. If I were Texas, I'd do it. I'd test the waters, damn it. But Rick Perry has already given a statement saying he's not going to do anything. Let's go to the phones. The number's 347-308-8701. Sally D.
Rick Perry, that pussy. I'd do it.
You would do it, JC? Oops, sorry, JC. I didn't mean to cut you off. And let's bring in Poverty Supreme, by the way, who's there too.
What's
JC,
something about
what?
What's something
yeah,
about
I'd do it in a heartbeat.
Hey,
I would.
If it would get more Republicans in the Senate, yeah, I'd do it too.
I'd break it down in six and leave a nice little gap in the middle to stick all of Puerto Rico.
That's just vicious. Hey, Sal, so how
that
are
when,
you?
So that when the jihadists, when they talk about America and they're talking about sticking it to America or giving America an enema, they'd know exactly where to stick the tube.
How are you doing, Sal?
Not bad, not bad. You know, I mean, you know, it's funny. I look at that same story with a, you know, it, for me, what it signifies, no, they're not seceding. It's not going to happen. But at the end of the day, what it does signify is a lot of pissed off people right now out there based on the, you know, the way things turned out. And I think, unlike past elections, I don't see this kind of fading off in the next month. I really don't. I think you've got a permanent division in this country now where as things begin to get worse, I see that just becoming just a total, you know, incendiary device waiting to go off. But how it plays out, I mean, I don't see the economy turning around right away, if at all. So I do see this anger coming forward in some shape or form, whether that's people moving, people preparing, or violence. I honestly don't know, but I don't see it going away.
Hey, let me make a prediction. Let me make a prediction for you, folks. I'm going to make a prediction for you. Trust me. You guys know, maybe you don't know. We do this thing on July 5th now. We're going to do it every year. And it's called Murder, Death, Kill.
Yeah, Murder, Death, Kill.
The breakdown of Murder, Death, Kill is the day after the 4th of July, when all the fireworks go off, the day after, we report on all the stories of all the people who have died or severely injured themselves in some fireworks mishap. I am predicting right now that there is going to be a story the day after Thanksgiving. And I'm not counting the violence that takes place at the toy stores on Black Friday. I am guessing that there are going to be stories about family gatherings for Thanksgiving that are going to turn to violence that are over this election.
Of course.
Because it's going to be the first time that those family members on either side of the aisle are going to get together, have dinner, have a few drinks, and they are going to go buck wild.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know what I'm waiting for? Let me tell you what I'm waiting for. The other day I was watching Obama when he interrupted my Young and the Restless when he gave a speech with regards to meeting with the Republican Party and hashing out their differences and because of the fiscal cliff that's on its way and, you know, getting together and working. And he said he's willing to compromise on everything but the tax hike. Oh, there we go. You dirty dog. For everything but those who make $250,000 a year or more in terms of raising those taxes. Now, if this is gonna happen, when does it go on? January 1st?
Yeah. It happens in fact, midnight, New Year's Eve.
Midnight New Year's Eve, correct?
Yeah.
Could you imagine the hell that's going to go on backstage at a Jay-Z concert? He gets $250,000 per show. Kanye West. They demand these prices. Beyonce. They get these prices per concert. here in America.
Yeah, but they told they want to vote.
And not only that, they don't have to pay it immediately, but listen, there's going to be a shortage of hip-hop and R&B concerts in the very future, period, because everybody's going to jail for tax evasion because nobody's going to want to pay it.
Well, I mean,
they
hold open in power.
They don't quite understand it.
Yeah, exactly. The bottom line is, but you know what? If you ask these guys, when they're asked, you know, they said, you know, anybody remember that interview that Will Smith was doing in France? He was talking to some guy in France, and it was talking about paying higher taxes. If you're rich, you pay higher taxes here. And Will Smith is talking about, you know, I support the president. I believe that we should pay more taxes. And the host in France tells Will Smith, is that, you know, they're going to do that here. You know, it's like, you know, I'm American. You know, I love America, and I want to support my country in any way that I can. And so the French host tell him, look, they're going to raise taxes to 75% on the wealthy in this country. Will Smith completely changed it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad to be an American.
Yeah, well, what do you think is going to happen when taxing you at 40% isn't enough? And,
right.
And it changes nothing. Then they're going to say they want half your ish. And you're going to have to decide half? Like, you know, at what point is it enough?
$20 million per movie?
Yeah, Mr. $20 million a movie, which in essence means you're just making 10.
Right.
You know, those guys don't feel it, man. You know, they don't feel it. They'll lose the money. But when you're making that kind of money, you don't feel it like the guy that's making, you know, has maybe $50 left in his pocket at the end of every week that's considered spending money. you know, that's
yeah,
the guy.
Yeah, but you know what? They're going to feel it. I'll tell you how they're going to feel it. They're going to feel it when they find out, hey, Will Smith, listen, I know we're doing a movie about New York, but we can't film it in New York. We got to go to Vancouver. Or, you know, we can't film it on location, so we got to go to Budapest and film the movie because the taxes are really, really low there. And, you know, we're filming a movie about America in other countries. We can't, you know, Bryan Cranston, who's in that very popular TV show Breaking Bad.
Love it.
I heard this interview about him saying he was on a plane with somebody else and they were talking about, hey, where are you going? He said that we're flying out to New Mexico. He's like, why do you guys shoot the show all the way in New Mexico? He said, are you crazy? In California, they're ripping us off in taxes. We had to go someplace where it was cheaper to produce the show. People
yeah,
aren't
but,
even
but,
filming
Reese.
There.
But Reese.
Yeah, poverty, go ahead.
But we got to understand.
Poverty, I got you. Go ahead.
What we got to understand, and what you know, because you're a very intelligent guy, and JC as well, is the simple fact that the reason why they put up all these taxes is to shut down the up-and-coming producers. Unless you come out of debt, unless you're going to work for one of the big guys like Spielberg, and what's his name, Stephen King, and
well,
George
saying,
Lucas.
Well, you're saying the conglomerate. You're saying
huh?
You're getting rid of the smaller production companies. You know, if you're
yeah.
not Universal, if you're not Paramount, you know, if you're not
yeah, they,
DreamWorks.
Right, programming.
Right.
Listen,
you know
Reese.
Go ahead.
Let me tell you. You remember Route 5, East Hartford, South Windsor? Route 5, that's where Cahoots is.
Right.
On that same street, just down past the center of East Hartford, you hit South Windsor. It's about maybe about a minute into South Windsor, heading north on Route 5, like heading towards the Enfield, East Windsor area, right where I hold my wrestling shows at. I hold them at Nomad's Adventure Quest.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like that's like a big, huge indoor amusement center. They have the rock wall climbing. In fact, he bought the old set from Nickelodeon, the one with a rock face. Remember, like when we were kids, they used to have that on there.
I do remember
the face with the talking rock. I forget what that was called. Legends of the Hidden Temple. He bought
uh-huh.
that whole setup and did a whole, you know, indoor sports. Amusement center for, you know, adults and kids. Across from that they're putting in this huge, I mean, I've never seen a building this big in my life. And we're talking not as tall, but in terms of, it takes about a good 3 to 4 minutes to drive just the side of this building, going up Route 5, and it's going to be a major motion picture studio. That's what it's for, because they lowered the taxes in Connecticut. That's why so many films are being filmed here now. They're trying to make Connecticut Hollywood East. But with Daniel Malloy, and I mean, and this guy, he came into Connecticut. He's a Democrat, but he came in with such crazy tax hikes in the state. I mean, they got rid of the clothing tax, where everything you bought under $50, you didn't get taxed on. Now you get taxed on even if you buy a pair of socks now. I don't know how that's going to hold up for the state and everything that they're trying to do here now as far as, like, taxes and filming.
Well, the whole idea is to tax everything. You know, there's a story today that I saw in Drudge Report that Obama wants to tax the Internet. You know, the idea is the only way to deal with this revenue crisis that's looming is to make sure that they take more money out of every person's pocket that they possibly can. We'll get you in little ways. You know, we used to have this one saying, Sal and Dennis will know this as well as I do. We've all had that grandpa or that dad, I guess in Dennis's case, who always had that line about that's how they get you. I'm sure you remember that line. You don't want to get the insurance on the rental car. That's how they get you. that was always my favorite line. And people laughed at that for eons and eons. But today, that is the template. That's how they get you. That's how they're going to get us. They're going to get us by
taxes. No doubt. But you know, at the end of the day, and this is the crazy thing about it, they'll get it. Okay.
Oh, yeah, they're
going to have a miserable society.
Oh, they're definitely going to get it. They're going to double down on getting it. They're going to, you know, when the carbon tax and poverty supreme, I don't know whether or not, in fact, I'm almost certain you guys have this in your country, but are you familiar with the carbon tax?
Yeah, I've heard about it.
Okay. Now, the whole idea in the carbon tax is they're going to tax you based upon how much you drive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've got insurance on my car, and I have to pay, if I go over 6,000 miles, I've got to pay for the miles after that, basically.
So,
and
wait,
they put a box
if you
in
go
my
over
car
6,000
well.
Miles, what, per month or per year?
For the year. And if they put a box in my car, there's a box in my car monitoring how much miles I do. And if I'm driving good or
bad.
Oh, my
God. So wait. Poverty, who puts the box in your car? The insurance company or
the
government?
Company. Well, let me tell you how they've done it. That was the cheapest insurance company I could get.
Okay.
I looked everywhere, and they were giving me the best package. You can't get cheaper than, but they monitor how much I drive. If I take breaks, like, they'll give me more miles, yeah, by how good I drive. Like, if I take regular breaks and stuff like that. Like, say, for example, so I drive to Kent from London, and if I drive straight back, and I stop and I drive straight back, they say that was I never took a long enough break, you know? Because sometimes I drive far distances and then I might move off again. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, so you're saying
like,
that
I might
if
drive
you go somewhere, let's say
yeah,
you drive
I
a considerable distance just to stay 15 minutes, you didn't have an interval of a long enough time before you drove back. So in essence, you're being carbon taxed.
Of course, they monitor how much, if I've been driving fast on a, how fast I've been driving, because sometimes I like to drive fast. If there's no police around, there's no cameras. I'll go maybe, because it's 30 on the road, so I might do 35, you know, 40. But obviously, the box knows what I'm doing, and it won't give me no. I haven't got no extra miles because they say, you know, I've always done everything wrong. You know, I don't take long enough breaks. On certain, you know, like if I hit the motorway, I'm doing like 100 or something. You know what I mean? But 70 miles.
So in essence, wait, hold on. Now, first of all, your privacy is completely taken away here because the insurance company knows everything it is that you're doing, with the exception of where it is that you're going. They know how far you're going and how fast you're going.
Yeah, they probably know. No, they said that they could locate my car if someone stole it, as well.
In that case, then I'll take back what I said before. So in essence, they know everything.
They know everything. They'll know it. They said that they could even know if I have an accident, they'll know who's in the wrong. Even if I was in the wrong, you know, if I was over speeding and stuff like that.
Well, they say that here in America that they've already got black boxes in cars.
Well, right. That was something that they were planning on doing back in 2008. That the idea was to take some of these newer SUVs that carry children, or, you know, just that they weren't going to do them in the smaller cars, but they wanted to do them in the SUVs. They wanted to put black boxes in them. But I think it was primarily because of the OnStar system, because the OnStar system can tell whether or not you've had an accident, and it will immediately detect it.
Well, I got news for you. I got news flash for you. up until 2008. Up until 2008, when you paid all that extra money for OnStar, you were paying, and you had your AAA already. You already had your AAA membership.
Uh-huh.
You were basically paying double. We were OnStar up until 2008. AAA.
So AAA was on start, and that was just like a farce. In other words, you guys just took on another service.
Listen, we were on start. We were GM. We were GM Roadside, Audi, Cadillac, Mini, Hummer Roadside. Yeah. We were Saturn.
That's a
Roadside.
Sham.
Yeah, we were all those roadsides.
That, my friend, is absolutely
when we got a roadside call at AAA, we had a separate computer at the end of the room.
That
and
would
when
let
it
you
rang,
know
it buzzed.
It one of those GM roadsides or OnStar.
Right. And that damn computer would ring, and it rang so loud half the time we ignored it because it was annoying. Because you have to get so much more information when you get it. You got to go over there and get it, pick up the bat phone, introduce it. Well, at the top, it'll tell you, you know, what it is, Saturn or Humvee or Mini Cooper. You have to answer that phone using that company's script. For example, I would answer the phone and say, hey, welcome to Mini Cooper Roadside, JC speaking. You know? And that's just
a total freaking ripoff.
And what's sad is that AAA operates as a not-for-profit organization. They're not non-profit. They're not for-profit. But at least a good 80% of our members were senior citizens with brand-new cars. And they carried the AAA just for peace of mind.
Well, listen, if you see what they're doing in England, and I don't care what anybody says, England is already the model for this administration. Whatever it is that they're doing there, look what Michael Bloomberg's doing.
Michael Bloomberg
went to London. He saw London itself has got a billion cameras all over the city. What did Bloomberg do? He went over to England and said, we want to implement that in New York City. You know, Obama wants smaller cars that are fuel efficient, just like they have in Europe.
Yeah.
If they can find a way to get you to
slow down your driving, charge you more if you drive more, and all that other stuff. It's coming. It's coming. We got 4 years. Trust me. I promise you that that's going to be the initiative, the carbon tax or some form of it, within the next year. We're going to see.
My brother, the same things they do to you guys, because they've got drones in the communities I'm hearing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, well,
I've never seen a drone before in real life.
I've seen them on TV. Miami's got some drones that they're testing. Denver, Colorado is thinking about doing some drones now. New York is really considering it. They're already testing them in New York City. But right now they've got a big fight with the ACLU in New York on whether or not that's going to happen. So it's a matter of time.
Guys have got stop and frisk, right? It's just a matter of time before we get that shit.
It all depends. We'll take a break. Stick around. We'll be right back to end the show. It's BlogTalkRadio.com. It is November the 13th, 2012. Show is almost over. 5 minutes left. By the way, since I have these 5 minutes, I want to say several things that each and every one of you should know. JC, are you about to interrupt me while I'm about to end the show?
I just want to know, are we going to talk about Elmo?
There's what, about the emails?
No, Elmo?
Elmo?
Yes.
It's just the emails. But let me just make this final announcement, and we'll end the show with Elmo.
Okay.
Anyway, one thing to remember. Folks, I want you to join me on Friday, November the 16th, that is this Friday, for Reese on the Radio's. Get ready for it. Get ready for it, folks. It is Reese on the Radio's 200th episode. A lot of you didn't know that. 200th episode. We have done 200
damn.
Episodes. What's that?
I said, damn, that was fast.
Yeah, I know. But remember, we started in January 3rd. We're almost near the end of the year. And we're already up to our 200th episode, so we would try to have some surprises. I'm working on them. Maybe we'll get a couple of people on the show. If not, what the hell? Who cares? But
let's talk yoga on Friday.
What's that?
Let's talk yoga? Yeah.
Never mind. Anyway, moving on. Also, check out frankwuco.com. That's Frank, WUCO. FrankWuco.com. He was our guest today. We want to thank him for joining the show. So, be sure to check him out. We're going to have him on really, really soon. As this Benghazi thing goes on and on, I think we're probably going to have him on a couple of times as this whole Benghazi thing unfolds. We might even have him here on Friday because there are a couple of hearings that are happening today. So be sure to tune in to each and every one of those things. What do you want to bring up about Elmo?
Well, the man accused has been cleared.
Pardon?
The man accused, Kevin Clash, he's been cleared. The guy recanted his story.
Stop it! When did you see this story?
That story's been out all day long, since about 5 o'clock this afternoon.
No, first of all, the emails were revealed by TMZ that say that Clash was talking about how he can't stop thinking about him or thinking about sex.
No, but it was a mutual. It turns out it was a mutually agreeable situation, and the claim of abuse was the lie. So I think that the physical contact was real, but
So you're saying that they did indeed have a relationship, but
oh, yeah,
now
they did have
the
a
young man is recanting.
But the guy wasn't 16 either.
Say again?
The kid wasn't 16 either.
Right.
What do you mean the kid was? Well, he's 23 now. He claims that this started when he was 16 and Kevin Clash was 45.
It's probably when he was 13, mate. I was saying it was probably when he was younger, but what I'm saying is that for a big man, yeah, to doing them sort of roles, there's something wrong with him, innit? Men who love kids, yeah, and they ain't got no kids of their own. That's a dangerous combination.
Yeah.
Especially when they're around little boys all the time.
I'd agree. But, I mean, this guy, he clearly wasn't 16 when they had the relationship.
Really?
Real men don't like kids unless it's their own kids.
Well, it's like they said about Michael Jackson. I mean... They said Michael Jackson was gay for years, but they said it more so after the accusations came out with the boys. And it's like, wait a minute, hey, it's not that he's gay; that would just make him a pedophile. It wouldn't necessarily make him gay, but none of it was proven.
JC, I'm gonna check out the story. We've got to go off the air. I will see you guys tomorrow. It's been a pleasure as always, folks. Thank you, Frank Buco, and thank you everybody. Property Supreme, Sally Dean from Massachusetts, and of course, Dennis the Mass Menace. We'll see you guys tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel. We love you. We'll see you then.